This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Some critics called The Wire the greatest television show of all time.
This remaining silent shit ain't nothing like they make it out to be.
The HBO series explored Baltimore's drug scene and the corruption of the city's social, governmental, and media institutions.
How many years you figure we've been doing this same shit?
20 at least.
Fans of The Wire seemed most attached to its authentic characters, people like Lieutenant Cedric Daniels, the Greek who smuggled drugs and humans, middle schooler Dookie Weems, drug kingpin Prop Joe.
State your name for the record.
Omar Devone Little.
And of course, Omar.
And what is your occupation?
Occupation?
What exactly do you do for a living, Mr. Little?
I rip and run.
You?
I robs drug dealers.
When you ask David Simon, the show's creator and my guest today, which character he loved writing most, he invariably answers, Baltimore. Baltimore looms large in Simon's life. He got his start as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Simon wrote Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, about his time spent with the Baltimore Police Homicide Unit. And then he created The Corner for HBO, a miniseries based on his book about the open-air drug market in West Baltimore. You might assume David Simon grew up in Baltimore in a family with a tradition of law enforcement. He didn't. He was raised in Washington, D.C., in a family where the tradition was words.
My father was a professional Jew, by which I mean he was the PR director for B'nai B'rith, which is like a Jewish service organization, and he did that for about 30 years. Argument was a way of communicating. I mean, rhetoric was prized in my household.
Simon's father had wanted to be a journalist. He'd studied it in college. But with a growing family, he opted for the security of public relations. His son David inherited his dad's passion for newsprint.
You know, once he saw that I was interested in newspapers as a teenager, he was like throwing like Swope and Damon Runyon and like, you know, Watch What He Does Here. And then once I got involved with The Sun, he threw Mencken at me. And so I was reading old guys, who a kind of newspaper style that isn't even allowed anymore. You know, and so I'm not sure Mencken could get published.
David Simon wrote for his high school paper in Bethesda, Maryland, and continued writing in college.
I worked on the college paper at Maryland, and I sort of wrote my way onto The Sun. I was a stringer for a year and sort of paid 30, 40 bucks a story. And I had so many bylines that the unions have sort of had to formally complain and say, you got to hire him if he's writing this much. I had like 100 bylines. And the Metro editor told the union quietly, look, when he graduates, we're going to hire him. So,
and they did.
And they did. You know, I didn't have to do the 3-4 years in Roanoke or like a smaller market paper to get to a major Metro daily. I got lucky. And that's...
Were you writing those 100 bylines when you were at this school? What were you writing about?
I was still trying to get out of... You know, by the time I finished editing The Diamondback, which was a broadsheet 5 days a week paper at Maryland... I had maybe 65 credits. I failed out so many times. I was the editor, so like I failed out 2 semesters in a row just for laughs.
You were a professional newspaper man who was hiding in a college, basically.
You know what? I tried to say that to my father, but he he's pissed away the
he's
tuition
still burned
checks.
About how you didn't play.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure he bought it, but I got it, and so I still had to get a degree even after I'd finished editing the paper. You know, I was on the 5-year-plus summer. Plan.
But what'd you write about?
And while I was there, I became their stringer. I don't know that I was looking, you know, it wasn't like I had the world as my oyster and I could have chosen a daily. As soon as I got hired at The Sun, it was like, okay,
it was understood.
That's where I'm going, you know. But I didn't know Baltimore at all. I mean, Baltimore was one of those places I drove through to go visit relatives in New York. And you'd like drive that 895, you know, the Harbor Tunnel and auto graveyards and, you know, rusting piers. And you'd think, you know, my God, you know, you take a wrong turn if you end up here, you know. And,
but you began at The Sun in 1980?
No, later than that, 83.
So in 83, you start at The Sun and you are developing a very deep understanding of Baltimore.
Slowly. I'd say the first few years I was just trying to figure out how to do reporting.
What'd you write about in the beginning?
Well, same thing I wrote about at the end. The joke is I never got promoted. I was a police reporter. I started as a night police reporter, which was very reactive. You know, you come in at 4 p.m. and you leave at 2, you know, it's all what happened yesterday. Police said. Mm. And eventually I sort of graduated to covering crime as an issue or the drug policy stuff as issues. But I never really got out of the crime game.
Did your attitude toward the police and policing evolve over the time that you were the reporter?
Yeah. I mean, I learned to respect good policing, and I still do. And eventually I learned that I had to move away from the singular point of view of the cops, because it's very easy when you're a reporter in the beginning to embrace who's giving you information. So if you're covering the courts, you know, you're listening to lawyers. And if you're covering the station house, the cops, you're going to, you know, it was much more accessible to go to the Western District and have their version of events than to go to the 1400 block of Carrollton and talk to the neighbors who, you know, didn't trust the Baltimore Sun to begin with. I mean, it was a predominantly black city, and most of the crime was rooted in the black community. And so I'm a white guy who grew up in the suburbs, so I got almost no skill set when it comes to, but, you know, there's an awful lot you can accomplish by just coming back and showing up as a little bit of the battle and then being willing to ask a stupid question.
When do you finish writing for The Sun? You stop when?
95,
and
I took
why?
A buyout.
You
well,
did.
The paper was going in a bad direction. It was the beginning of what was happening in the newspapers, but it was not.
And you mentioned that there were limitations put on you in the work you were doing. What were those?
What they valued in journalism, I had very little regard for, and what I valued, I wasn't unable to convey the importance of it to them. I mean, we were speaking different languages, the guys who came in once we were bought up by the chains. And it wasn't that they wanted mediocre things. It was that they actually had deep ambitions, but they were sort of the prize culture ambitions. Five-part series, the Baltimore Sun has learned. It's better if it's unsourced, even if the source would go on the record. It makes it sound like we did more work. I mean, there was like almost a formula. And I was much more interested in how the city actually works or doesn't work. And that stuff's complicated. And like if you're trying to slice off a five-part series or a three-part series of outrage in order to win a prize, you have to discard the stuff that is maybe going the other way, or it makes the issue complicated. I mean, one of the editors at The Sun who became predominant when I knew it was time to leave, he'd won a couple of Pulitzers in Philadelphia, and one of them was for, and I'm sure they were very good stories, but one of them was very literal. It was the canine unit of the police department. The dogs are biting too many people. They're biting more people than in other cities. And I'm sure the series has its merits, but not everything is. You know, the real issues facing American cities aren't if we can just get the dogs to stop by. You know, it's like I was much more interested in why isn't the drug war working?
The priority shift.
Yeah. Like, why are we doing the same things over and over again and having less and less?
What did you think was wrong with Baltimore? What do you think were Baltimore's biggest problems?
Nothing that isn't wrong with most of urban American policy at this point, one of the more fundamental problems was they were committed to a national drug prohibition that is just incredibly destructive.
No, if you stop in 95, you said, is when you took the buyout from them?
Right. It was
and
the
then
third
you started,
buyout.
And then, were you a television person? Were you a television
no.
watcher? You, so
no.
So how the hell did you end up?
It was a mistake. It's really been a hilarious mistake. One of my dear friends who died while we were working on Treme was David Mills, and we worked on the college paper together. And I remember being on the college paper, and this was the time of Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere and those shows. And I could admire the craft of those shows and see that something sort of fresh was happening. But I was, you know, I was in my early 20s and I wasn't hanging around to watch. I could never get in front of the television set on the right night. So I caught a little of it here and there. But David, we'd be rolling the paper at 10 o'clock at night. And it's like, you know, we're just trying to get the pages out to get them printed. And David would like go, hold on, I got to go watch Hill Street. And he'd go into the office and sit down with a little black and white TV and watch it as if it mattered. And we'd tease him. It'd be like, you know.
Some people like TV.
Yeah. Dave, the Ed page isn't going to roll.
God bless them.
Right. God bless them. So I was not. I watched sports and I watched reruns of Bilko and the Honeymooners with my dad. You know, it was like a sharing experience. You know,
sure.
That's it. The newspapers had primacy in my house. It was just
back when people got more than one paper.
Right. We got the Star.
A morning and an evening paper.
Washington Star, Washington Post, Times on Sundays.
So when you leave The Sun, what do you do?
Well, I had a bunch of opportunities there. I mean, I was working on a second book. I'd written a book called Homicide mm-hmm. when I was a reporter. And it was a nonfiction narrative of a year I spent in the homicide unit.
Who was your publisher?
Houghton Mifflin. Once I said the police department of Baltimore was letting me into the homicide unit for a year, that access sort of guaranteed that I was going to get some kind of advance that I could live on while I researched the book. And so there was a little bit of an auction, a small you know, enough that I got enough to live on, and took a year's leave of absence from the paper, went into the unit, wrote the book, came out in 91, and Barry Levinson, the filmmaker from Baltimore, he bought it, and he was looking to make a show at NBC, and they made Homicide. And it was this weird stepchild, because I went back to the Sun. I didn't think much of it.
You weren't involved?
No. I mean, I just sold him the book, and
my brother Daniel did that show.
That's right. Yeah, of course. And we were going to get there eventually. But yeah. So this stepchild from my book is existing. And I go back to being a reporter. Gail Mutrix offered me the chance to write the pilot. And I said, maybe wisely, maybe not. Wisely because I didn't know what the hell I would have been doing. I said, get somebody who knows what they're doing to do this. I'm a newspaperman. But maybe unwisely when I saw the per episode royalty that went to that guy.
Sure.
You know? And I said, once you have some scripts together, send me so I'll see the template and maybe I'll try to write one instead. Yeah, we wrote one late in first season and it was so dark and so depressing that NBC wouldn't make it. The show starts running and I wrote this one script with David Mills. Like when they gave me the assignment, and they said, yeah, take a script. I said, well, I don't know TV from Adam, but David loved this stuff. And so I call him up. He was at the Washington Post at the time. We'd gone on to different newspapers. And I said, how you been? How's it going? We're going to write a TV script. We got about 2 weeks. And so we hold up and we turn this thing in. And about half of it was our stuff. It turned out to be an episode that Robin Williams was in. They cast Robin Williams in the sort of the lead guest part. And once they cast him, they had to like give him more scenes. Some of our stuff got tossed, but about half of our stuff, 50% of it, was probably our pages. So I thought we'd failed miserably. You know, if you're half rewritten on a newspaper, if half your story isn't your words, if the rewrite man had to come behind you for that much, you know, you screwed up. Hmm. So I was sort of ashamed and like, well, okay, I guess we didn't do what they wanted. But they came back and offered us another script. And so at some point, there's this buyout for my newspaper on the table, and the newspaper's going in a direction I don't admire. And they offered me a job in that window. So I wrote two scripts in the course of like a month, one for NYPD Blue and one for Homicide. And I admired both shows, and they were both very fair offers. Tom Fontana said, I'll teach you how to do this, and you're going to want to learn how to actually produce.
And did he?
Yes. He kept that promise with a vengeance.
What did you learn from Fontana?
Pretty much everything.
Yeah, one of the most successful TV writers in the last 50 years.
You know, and I mean, in the end, Tom was as good as his word in the sense of, at first, all you're doing is writing and you're just moving scenes and you're, you know, filling in, you know, but eventually set coverage and, you know, protecting the writing when it's on set and troubleshooting. Well, you want to make sure that you're getting the intention of the scene because merely because it's a script doesn't mean it's headed for anywhere good. You have to protect it while at the same time giving the actors and the director a chance to make it their own as well. But you have to keep the core value of what the story is. And I've come to believe that, you know, if you have a good crew, if you have good actors, everybody's kind of a well-sharpened tool. And if they know their business, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. But somebody has to look out for story as a whole and protect story as a whole, particularly in an intricate drama that's
everything. Some sets I've been on, the actors are better at keeping their eye on the story as a whole than the writers themselves.
I've not found that, but that may be something that you and I, we're going to differ on until the end of time. Everybody has to settle for, at certain points, for 85 or 90% or even 80% of your intention as you go into the day's work. There comes that moment where you're fighting to get 60%, and then there's trouble. Then it has to be resolved because that's not enough. But, I mean, I think in some ways, you have to leave room for everybody to be creative, and that's a real delicate thing. So I learned that, and then, you know, somewhere at about a year and a half, I was summoned to New York to sit by the Avid and watch what Tom did when he cut, and that was another education. You know, at a certain point, you get sent to casting. You know, there's a whole skill set of show running that.
And when did that end? When did you walk away from Homicide?
Homicide ended in 99.
So as Homicide is winding down and you either sense that it's going to end or did it end abruptly or you kind of knew it was coming?
I took the job with Homicide thinking I'll do this while I was working on a very complicated manuscript of my second book, which was about a year spent on the drug corner. It was a follow-up to Homicide.
The corner.
Yeah, a drug corner in West Baltimore.
So were you – was The Wire something that you were cooking up while you were – developing and or shooting and or posting and or debuting The Corner?
A lot of people think The Wire came in the wake of The Sopranos, but when we wrote The Wire scripts for the first season, we hadn't seen The Sopranos. We were writing in the absence of The Sopranos. We were writing in the shadow of Oz. Oz was the first time that HBO had ventured into this, hey, we'll put it on TV and you've never seen it before, on TV territory. So that was, when I saw the pilot of Oz, I went to Tom and said, you know, you could do a show about a drug corner. And for reasons that, you know, are elusive to me now, Tom and Barry were joined at the hip, and Barry didn't want to do The Corner. He didn't want to send it up for series. I think Tom wanted to, but, you know, it was, and I think to give Barry.
Did that end up being a good thing for you?
Yeah. I mean, it ended up, Tom set up
the
meeting.
Less of a piece of it to Tom.
Right. At the time, I was like, oh, now I got to walk into a room with at HBO without
and did
Tom.
You?
Yeah.
But and what happened?
Tom set the meeting up.
Okay. And what happened?
Well, I got in the room, and they had already read the book, which was a miracle by L.A. standards. You know, it
they
wasn't a memo.
They in business with you.
Yeah. Two of the three people in the room had actually read the book. And I was trying to sell them The Wire. Finally, Carrie Antholis, who was the head of miniseries at the time, said, we just want you to do the book. Can you just do the book as the book is, as a mini? And I said, okay, you know, better than nothing. So I was in the miniseries business. The only caveat they had was, we happen to notice you're not black. And your co-writer, who's Ed Burns, former police detective on The Corner, he's not black either. Can you get a black, you know, do you know any black?
Literally.
And I said, well, there's this.
Can you get a black guy in here?
Yeah. Can we can we make a marriage?
What'd you do?
Well, I said, you know, I thought, they said, well, you know, I know this guy, Dave
Bondi
Mills.
Bondi Curtis Hall came sprinting into the room to co-produce with you.
I had Dave Mills in my pocket. I mean, we'd been friends since college. So I said, I know this guy Mills, you know, right?
But literally, they thought for the credibility of the series, you needed to have an African American.
I don't
voice.
Think they'll deny it to this day. Right. They were nervous about presenting depictions of African Americans that were rooted in the underclass,
and probably very smartly so.
Right, and I don't blame them. You know, television. You know.
So who did you get again? Who was your
Dave Mills, the guy from college? He was okay. Dave Mills was black. So Dave Mills and I said, and I walked out of the HBO building, you know, into Century City. And I basically, like, I got on my cell phone and I said, Dave, what are you doing for the next year?
Dave, I need a black guy. Get over here.
And he said, what do you mean, what am I doing? I think he was on L.A. Law. He was doing episodes for L.A. Law at the time.
God, that's funny.
And I said, well, you're writing a miniseries based on The Corner. And he goes, I am? I said, yeah. And he goes, how did that come up? And I told him. He was laughing his ass off. He said, all right, this will be good. So I ended up doing that. And then
how
I thought.
How many hours? Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
It was six hours. And it did okay. I mean, nobody watched it. Who, you know, it's the underclass, and it's America. You know, it's not like people were dying for.
Did you like it?
I thought we did very well with it. It was very true to the book. It was very honest with the book, which I cared about.
So both projects thus far are linked to books.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm thinking, now I'm going to go back and write another book, which, you know, believe me, if my book editor, God bless him, John Sterling, is listening right now, he's just, you know, he just spit out a couple of teeth. But I'm thinking I'm going back to books, and I'm going to go to a newspaper, and I'm going back to journalism.
You're going to go back, period.
Yeah, I'm going back. And now the window is, you know, now that I finished The Corner and Homicide's over, it's a nice skill set to have learned, but I'm not looking for I'm looking to go back. And then the fateful words. I like reporting. I love reporting. I like actually the time spent, even on a fictional story, the time spent in research.
But is there something about you, not that you have to answer this, that you like it a little less glitzy? Were you getting kind of fatigued by that?
I'm an East Coast guy. Right. And I will tell a story on myself and George Pelkanos, one of the novelist writers, a good friend of mine. We're in L.A. for, I think we're going to some meetings and maybe an awards thing. I'm in L.A. usually 6 days a year for meetings. George wanted to go to the Ivy, so we got a reservation at the Ivy. And, of course, we were down on the sidewalk for 45 minutes, you know, waiting. And then the beautiful hostess comes down and looks around and says, after they've taken every other, you know, actor, yeah, and says, Pelican party, you know. I turned to George, I said, we don't belong here.
Yeah. You know, they just sat Ruth Westheimer before us.
Great. Let's go home.
Yeah.
I have very little patience for that stuff. Not because it sounds arrogant. It sounds like, oh, he's such a down to earth, you know, the Baltimore under his fingernails, and, you know.
But you go out there and you realize it's not for everybody.
No, it really is not. And listen, there's a lot to love about the entertainment industry.
especially when it goes well.
And nobody's throwing the money back when it, you know, when the residual checks come to your mailbox, sure. You don't throw them out on the ground in disgust.
Well, the note that says, no, thank you.
Yeah, no one ever says, no, thank you. But I was supposed to write towards argument. Like the stuff was supposed to be about something.
Was it in the corner?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was.
And you were going to go write another book about?
I think the next one was supposed to be, in my head, I wanted to do The Working Class. It was what we cannibalized for season two of The Wire. First, I had asked, I'd made some quiet inquiries about going to Beth Steele, the steel plant, which was still sort of operating a skeleton shift in Baltimore, a very big steel plant, and also the GM factory, about whether they'd let me work the line. You know, I can't help it. I'm from a different planet, which is journalism. And what I'm really interested in, even in making film, even as a filmmaker, is the argument that can come as a result of the narrative.
I certainly don't know you, but judging from your work, Homicide and The Wire and Tremé, you seem like someone who comes from a comfortable middle-class existence and an educated background. The plight of the poor is something that gnaws at you, correct?
I'm interested in a story that has political import and that can say something fresh and worthy of argument. I'm not sure I ever sort of saw it as being...
socialism.
Yeah. Well, I would say my politics are to the left of the Democratic Party. I'm probably what in Europe would be called a democratic socialist. But having said that, I think I was very fair as a reporter. You know, some of poverty is about personal responsibility and some of it is not. Some of it is systemic and a result of societal forces that are profound. And you can't ignore either. And I think the reporting in the corner and also some of the implications of The Wire.
People I know who liked The Wire loved The Wire.
Well, that came very late in the run, and it came as a result of things that I don't think we anticipated, which are sort of power watching through whole seasons at a time. You know, once on demand and DVD sets became those things,
binge viewing.
Yeah, we were still locked into the man. We hope they watch it on Sunday nights or in the rewatches when we first came on the air. All the other platforms didn't exist, so we didn't know that it would have a long tail, and at the time. It was really about begging to let us finish the narrative.
How many seasons of The Wire did you do?
Five.
How many episodes?
60. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you learn before? I mean, and even though the collaboration with Tom in particular and with Barry was a good one, now this is your house and this is your thing. The Wire is you.
Yeah.
And what was your personal touch you wanted to put on? What were things you wanted to do that you weren't able to do before?
I thought Homicide was an exceptionally good show, really well acted and, you know, well written.
It was a TV drama nonetheless.
Right.
Whereas most people agree that The Wire was something that was much more bristled with authenticity, the dialogue.
Well, I mean, what The Wire had going for it was there was nobody to appease. There were no, you know, there was nobody looking over your shoulder. I remember when we pulled we had good numbers. We had okay numbers first season. We had even better numbers second season. And then third season, the numbers dove. That was the first season that NFL started programming Sunday Night Football.
And then
Desperate Housewives was on another channel.
Show.
So we were getting the crap kicked out of us. And I remember calling Carolyn thinking, man, they may cancel us. And I said, you know, what was the number last Sunday? And she read it back to me. And yeah. I said, oh, man. And she goes, oh, come on. It's a cute little number. I don't want you thinking about numbers. That's astonishing.
Well,
that's astonishing.
So what did you want to do differently than you? What were some things you thought, if I had my own show, I'd do what?
I guess, yeah, that was where we got in on this. And I think the one thing I wanted to do is I looked upon Homicide as being 22. It was like a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever I compare stuff to books, people think I'm saying, oh, The Wire is as good as Moby Dick or whatever. And I'm never saying that. I'm always just using books as, you know, okay. Homicide was Dubliners. You know, it's all connected, but it's James Joyce's Dubliners. These delicately connected stories about a place and an ethos and you know, 22 separate stories. And there's some storylines continue, but each story, you know, there's a fresh theme for each. It was short story writing in a television sense. And I really wanted to see what would happen if you sort of applied the logic of a novel. And so that, like stuff that happens in the first couple chapters might stay relevant or have
a the old style of TV, which is what we don't have now, which is now everybody wants a one-off.
Right.
Why are these police procedurals like NCIS and everything so popular? Because you watch one episode and it's all
right. I'm not sure that it doesn't present its own level of problems, but I have to say, you know,
but it plays well into the binge viewing thing, where if you're going to connect everything like a novel, and I can sit down on an afternoon and I can watch 3 hours of your show.
Although it plays well like in retrospect, you have to have a certain number of viewers get to the end and start talking about it and say you got to go get the box set, you got to go watch all these. I look at these TV things as being a chance to have a discussion about something more than I wish these two characters would get together. I wish that he wouldn't have gotten killed. You know, I understand that viewers experience it that way, and they're not wrong. But man, if all you're doing is being entertaining, then I've sort of, you know, I don't know that I can sort of like look sort of the ghost of my father in the eye at night and say, you know, that leaving newspapers that I'm anything but an apostate.
In fact, David Simon has become increasingly vocal in his opinions about our country's drug war. He said he hoped The Wire would move, quote, from the entertainment pages to the op-eds, unquote. Last year, Simon appeared in The House I Live In, Eugene Jarecki's documentary about drug policy in the U.S.
We are the jailingest country on the planet, beyond Saudi Arabia, North Korea, or China. Nobody jails their population at the rate that we do. And yet, drugs are purer than ever before. They're more available. There are younger and younger kids willing to sell them. It'd be one thing if it was draconian and it worked. But it's draconian and it doesn't work. And it just leads to more.
Talk about Jarecki and how you met him.
Well, one of the things that The Wire was clearly intended as is a critique of the drug war and drug prohibition. So I spoke very bluntly about what I thought had gone wrong with the drug war. And at some point, you know, when people would call me and they'd say the magic words, which is, you know, I'm doing a story or I'm doing a documentary or can I interview you about the drug war? I always say yes. And in fact, in all the public speaking I do, I always come back to one of my fundamental arguments, which is that if you're an American citizen and you believe in any kind of democratic ideal, you might want to seriously consider jury nullification. If you're picked on a jury for a nonviolent drug offense of being one of those Americans who, you know, refusing to put another American in jail over drug prohibition, you're not helping solve the problem. And you're leading to an incarcerative American
gulag.
You're
feeding the problem.
Yeah, you're feeding the problem. Since I don't think there's any political leadership that's going to get there in advance of actual popular sentiment, I think it's very much like, for example, gay rights. You know, I think by the time the politicians line up, change is already inevitable. Mm. And so I think the drug war is the same thing, and that's how prohibition finally fell on its ass, which was that they couldn't find 12 Americans to put a 13th in jail for making bathtub gin. So I always take the gig and I always argue for jury nullification. And it's happening in places like Baltimore.
In a minute, David Simon and I reminisce about our worst Hollywood pitch meetings involving Abercrombie & Fitch models and the origins of the Chesapeake Bay.
And I realized, once again, I'm in the wrong place.
Yes. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. This is Alec Baldwin. The city of Baltimore is still a character in David Simon's life. He and his wife, writer Laura Lippman, live there with their 3-year-old daughter. He also has a 19-year-old son. But Baltimore no longer takes center stage in his work. Simon produced Generation Kill, an HBO series about the invasion of Iraq, and is working on the 4th and final season of Tremé, also for HBO, a drama that follows a neighborhood in New Orleans as it struggles to rebuild after Hurricane Katrina. Simon says working on Tremé made it even clearer to him what works and what doesn't in television.
Two things are still the great currency, even in this golden age of television: sex and violence. If you have hot people hooking up, then you've got one. Then you're spending one currency.
Yeah.
And if you have,
then they're going to turn to the next page.
Yeah. And if you're blowing shit up and killing people, then you got something else going for you. Well, The Wire was what it was about, and it was something we wanted to tell a story about. But clearly, it had the currency of being a gangster story underneath you know, at least on the surface, that's what it was. It was a crime story. And the corner was that, and Generation Kill had Marines blowing shit up. You know, there have been very few television shows that embrace the idea of real human beings on a real human scale. It's really hard to do. It's hard to keep people interested. I'm not saying Tremé succeeded in any grand way, because I think it's been a very quiet show, and it has. I'm hoping it will stand for what it is, and people will find it. But we were not interested in being hyperbolic with the show. You know, we weren't interested in tarting it up, and we weren't interested in the violence that there is in the show. Is actually corresponds to the dynamic of violence in the city of New Orleans, and not more. It's really a show about the role of culture in bringing a city back, and what it means to be. Live in a pluralistic society that is capable of creating pluralistic culture, which is what better form for it than American music, roots music, jazz, blues, whatever. You know, how many shows can you name that are really, you know, I mean, maybe like the first couple seasons of Northern Exposure, or these shows that basically are studies of place and time and character. And, you know, there are people who, the moment they realize that you're not going to, that, you know, no vampire is going to show up or nobody's going to be fucking, you know. It's like, waiter, check, please, you know. So I never want to do one more pitch than I have to do in life. Those meetings.
Do you have another show up your sleeve?
I mean, I'm in this little cocoon of HBO, and I hope they take something that I'm interested in, and we'll see.
Do you have some ideas?
Yeah, but, you know, it's not even worth talking about. I mean, you know how many things.
No, I don't want to pick your brains about it. I'm just saying, do you have some things?
No, I'm just saying it's not worth talking. You know, until something gets a green light, it's just really not worth
it. Exactly.
But I can tell you that I did do the round robin of, like, I have an idea that I really care about, and I went to, like, all the little meetings with the production development companies. And you know, I remember telling one that very delicate, true story of Baltimore that I really wanted to do as a small movie. I remember having one meeting after another, and the last time I actually uttered anything about it was I was at this movie over in one of the lots or at this meeting, and they listened really intently, and I'm like laying it out with the character, and then this happened, and I knew this guy, and when he died, and you know, I'm bleeding out, and you know, they listened patiently for 25 minutes, after which the guy says to me, "Have you ever thought about where the Chesapeake Bay came from? You're from Baltimore." And I said, "The Chesapeake Bay?" He said, "Yeah. Do you know where the Chesapeake Bay came from?" I said, "Well, it's kind of this long estuary. I think it was sort of where they think there's probably a meteor strike. You know, it's that sort of." He goes, "That's right." And I remember looking at him and going, "And that's the story, a meteor strike?" And he nodded firmly. And I left thinking, what an idiot. You know, I can't believe I just wasted, you know, half an hour in there. What a freaking moron. Cancel all the meetings. I'm just going home. Like, the other studios all had meteor movies, and this guy, and I realized, once again, I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah, people sitting in a crab shack saying, the meteor is coming. They've got their bibs on.
Very sentimental and romantic version.
Yeah, very. I remember I was in a meeting once years ago. This is many years ago, the mid-90s, and I thought, oh, the movie business is such a drag. It's so painful, and I was really had this crisis of faith, and I go to this meeting with some pretty big people at Warner Brothers Television, and I say to this guy, he says, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I have an idea for a television show." I said, "I want to refurbish the FBI, the old Quinn Martin. I want to do the FBI, and I want it to be, and I want to put together the most elite team of actors I can think of, the greatest actors that I admire today. It's me and Andre Brower and Treat Williams, and I had this list of all these really tough guys that seem like FBI guys that could throw a punch and shoot a gun, and they just don't even move." And as a joke, as a complete joke, I said, "Or I'm like the Michael Conrad character in Hill Street Blues. I come up and do the shape up in the morning, and it's me and like six Abercrombie and Fitch models are my staff." And I sit there and say, "Be careful out there." And they go out and have like crimes in, you know.
And every episode ends with a beach volleyball.
Every episode ends with like Team America. You know what I mean? Like two plastic looking gorgeous people having sex. And the guy literally went, he goes, "Now that show I want to make." I mean, I'm not kidding. With an ounce of irony, he goes, "Now that I want to make." He goes, "That's a great idea.
Yeah, sign that one up."
He said, "Let's do that, FBI." So, yeah. But one last thing. You have a child who's 19. What's he doing now?
He's at college.
What's he studying?
He's a freshman, so I think he's sort of, you know.
Has he got the bug?
What bug?
Show business.
Oh, God, no.
No.
He's actually a musician. He plays jazz piano at a very high level.
He hasn't even started yet, and he wants to go back.
Yeah, that's right. He so far, that hasn't happened. Now, the young daughter is a performer
now,
already.
What's that like for you? Because I'm in the same boat. I got a 17-and-a-half-year-old daughter
right.
and a baby coming.
Right.
How's fatherhood for you,
well,
part two?
Okay, let's be honest. You feel it when you have to get up off the floor.
Yeah.
It's easy to get down there and play with them when they're 2 years old.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's different than it was when I was in my 30s, and now I'm now in my early 50s. And when I get down on the floor, it's like, get the Derek to get me up.
Because
you feel it in the knees. All of a sudden, it's like, man,
I'm a 50-year-old parent. You don't realize you can actually lay there and watch Mary Poppins over and over again. You're fine.
Right. My wife says that, and I think very, very aptly, that when you're younger and you're parenting, you can go without sleep. You can be physically exhausted. You have
still
stamina.
Perform.
Yeah,
work.
Yeah. You have stamina that you didn't know you have because you're young. When you're older, hopefully, if things have gone a little bit right, and you're an older parent, you've got enough money so that you can. There's somebody there to help you with 6 or 5 or 4 hours of childcare a day. Because, man, I definitely feel like I'm in my 50s. So,
well, as my friend Michael Lally, the poet, said to me, who had a son later in his life, he said, it's great. I said, you had a kid. You were like right around my age. He said, yes. I said, has it been everything you hoped it would be? He said, yes, it's great. It changed my life and reprioritized my life. I was so ready for fatherhood. I think I'm a good dad. I have a great relationship with my son. He said, there's only one thing I remind people who are my age to keep in mind, and that is when your kid goes to college, make sure that they attend a university where the commencement is held at a wheelchair-accessible facility. That's the only thing you have to remember.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to keep that in mind.
I fear the future in some respects. But on the other hand, once you go across the threshold, no giving it back, and I wouldn't. If I could. Yeah.
Well, my last question for you is, because to me, The Wire was about an authenticity, which is often missing from a television drama, which, you know, they've got their formula, they've got their edicts and everything. They've got their recipe that works for them. But yours makes me think, you're ripe to make movies. Do you ever want to make movies?
Well, the writer's not, get the writer off the set. You know, it's the reason they had that the writer's in charge in television, in drama anyway, is the need for continuity, the need for character continuity. You know, you can't fire the son of a bitch because episode 11 follows from episode 10, you know. And so I've had a few bites of the apple, and I've written some things that, you know, and I think, listen, it's also, I'm not saying that
but
I'm...
But what if they gave you the script and, we're in the age of the fully realized writer-director? Everywhere I turn around, they say, Evan's going to be directing the script.
See, I know what I'm not good at. And
you don't want to direct.
I see shot composition. I mean, I would do a very pedestrian job of directing. I understand how to turn the camera around. I understand, what you need to leave with in order to have coverage. But the really creative and elegant directors I've worked with, they have a skill set that I don't have.
That's very interesting for you to say.
And I
feel the same way.
I really respect it. I didn't care enough. Right. I understand when I'm watching a performance that isn't working because it's not getting the intention of the scene or because I don't believe in something, either the background or the actor. If something's not working, I know it's not working. But how to solve the problem sometimes, I can be diagnostic. I can't be prescriptive when it comes to a camera.
I would watch some of the greatest cinematographers, and I would say truly that probably the most gratifying part of my film work was to be around these highly gifted monastic men.
The first time I showed up, 1 minute I was a rewrite man and crime reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and the next moment I was working for this show, Homicide, and my paychecks were coming from NBC. And I go to set for the first day, and I'm looking around and I don't even know what stupid question to ask. And it was like 3 weeks into going to set and seeing them do it that at some point I said, what's Boots over there? The guy's name was Boots. I said, what's he doing turning that knob next to the camera? And Henry Bermell, actually, I remember, turned to me and said, he's focusing the camera. And I looked at him like, I said, you mean the guy who focuses the camera isn't the guy looking through the camera? How does that work? That can't possibly work.
People are unprepared for how collaborative film
right, exactly.
is.
And so respect the depth, and I do, which is to say I kind of want to have the story turn out. I don't want to put my name on something where the story, you went in with a script you believed in and you came out with Drek. But at the same time, so I kind of don't want to relinquish control. But I have to acknowledge features is very different from TV.
Doing the television series, doing 30 Rock, where we shot, you know, 120-something episodes. We were there hour after hour after hour. My version of So Long As You Know was they'd say to me, do you mind if we move the camera? We're going to move the camera over here. So when you turn, we need you to lean on your left leg. And I would look at them. I mean, I did it 1,000 times. I'd say, I really don't care what you do. I said, because I'm going to change.
I'm going to be in this moment.
I'm going to stand here and say this line this
way. You find it.
Oh, you want me to lean on my left leg? Great. That's fine. Otherwise, I really don't care.
I don't know how anybody hits a mark. I don't know how anybody hits a mark. I have to admit it. But, you know, I watched that show. I have to say, I am a fan of that show. My wife turned me on to it years ago, and it's just the reason that that show is so unique in terms of comedy is it does something that you haven't seen since, like, the Howard Hawks comedies and – it's funny, but it's operating at a speed that I would call His Girl Friday speed.
Yeah.
The lines rapid fire.
Don't wait.
Yeah, don't wait. Don't wait. It's like, you know, we're not waiting for a laughter.
We all kind of huddled up at one point. I mean, it was unspoken, but we said, we really have to play this fast.
Right. And it's
– if we slow down, it's dead.
It has the same level of rapid fire banter as the best sort of Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell type. You know, the speed at which
– Tina's good.
Well, it really works, and it's unique.
Tina's good.
I mean, there's so much that is so much more careful and languid, and so is, to my taste, less funny.
Yeah.
It's just – I like it to be fast.
Well, I look forward to seeing what you do next. I can't wait.
Well,
we think that movie thing. I think you could make some
Yeah, you know,
movies.
Listen, I may be back to you about that.
I got a proposal for you.
About that FBI
about
show.
About the FBI show?
Yeah.
I got an idea. Tell your son to go to film school. Then the director is your son, and he wouldn't dare touch your script.
Believe me. That,
am I wrong about that?
He'd be out of the will in 2 years.
Oh my, okay.
I mean, that's a recipe for – at some point, I was working on – you know, my wife is a novelist, and at some point, George Pelkanos, a guy I work with routinely, we're looking at a project, and he says, you know, we really need a good, strong female writer. I said, you know, why don't you ask Laura to come into the writer's room on this? And I said, you know, why don't you just call the lawyer now? I'm going to be in the writer's room. You know, George, you know how badly we treat each other. You know, can you imagine trying to do this with somebody, you know? And he's been persistent. But like that, you know, there has to be something. There has to be some, you know, every child should go off and find their own joy.
Yeah.
And they should not be burdened by. And you know, he can play Thelonious Monk to death, and he's 19.
I said that to my daughter.
And I can't figure out how he's doing his court.
My daughter's 17 and a half, and you try to explain this to them, and it's hard. I say to her, I say, you're going to turn around at my age, and you're going to realize that you postponed doing certain things to be happy. And I say to my daughter now, I say, you don't postpone that journey or that consideration of what makes you happy.
Right.
Because I'm doing this, and it doesn't always make me happy what I'm doing in this business. It's a job. Sometimes it does.
You know, right. Well, the trick in this business is knowing when you're no longer – at least if you're operating as a writer, this may not be – but I think it's probably true for an actor too. But when you're no longer doing work that is – that the journey itself is interesting, and when you're doing work that is – you're saying either the same thing that you've already said before or you're saying the same thing – to no purpose, like, well, okay, this is what they're paying me for today. It's like, that's the point at which, you know, it's time to do something else. And it's like the one thing that David Mills told me, and he died, you know, the guy who I wrote my first script with came with me on Tremé. He was a producer on Tremé, and he died of an aneurysm before the show came out. It was really, you know, on set, collapsed. I mean, I miss him to this day. But he told me something. He said, he goes, the only reason that you're He went out to L.A. full bore and tried to get network shows, development deals, and he went through the whole route. He said, the amazing thing is, and he told me, don't lose this, is you are okay if they come to you and say, you know, it's all been very nice, but nobody watches your shit, and we're going to go somewhere else, and, you know, we're done with you. And it's like, at no point, like, you know, if somebody has a hit with a courtroom show, everyone's running around trying to figure out how to do a courtroom show. If everyone has a medical show, because you're the only guy in this freaking industry that basically is okay if they throw you off, if the plate spins and you fall off the plate. And I've always had that in the back of my pocket. It's like the Wandering Jew of, you know, I got a bag packed. When there's no longer a place for what I'm trying to do, it's okay.
It sounds like, in one sense, that a show business career And I mean, although the shows were not, you know, you're not, these television shows haven't been these juggernauts, let's say, like Botchka or what have
not
you.
Not by any means.
But that aside, I mean, but I'm saying that doesn't matter. I mean, they've been very well regarded and very well respected people. Like I told you, people who love The Wire, it's like hashish to them. I mean, they love this thing. And Ben, for you, you have this, it seems, very healthy attitude because this was all an accident anyway.
Right. I feel like I'm on borrowed time since the moment I got into this industry.
This is not where you were sailing your ship to begin
and,
with.
And I feel the guilt of an apostate who has had a marvelous run at, you know, since he left the religion. So I'm it's okay if HBO were to come to me and say, we're never making another hour with you. And good luck and God bless. I'd still cross the street to give him a hug if I saw him come the other way 3 years later and if I never worked. It's like this has been something that was totally unexpected. That it happened at a time where newspapers were collapsing all around me. It was just fortuitous, you know, because there was a part of me that was really torn when this started happening. To this day, I miss reporting. So it's okay, whatever happens. There are a lot of people in this industry that, you know, staying on top at any cost. And they'll find themselves telling stories they don't actually care about because that's the story that somebody else wants. And that to me is like a journey into hell. Mm-hmm. So, and I can see how it happens. And let's face it, you know, there's a lot of money in this industry. So it can happen. But man, the only thing healthy, he said, you got a lot of unhealthy shit in your head, Dave. But the one thing Mills said was, you know, is that you're okay if it ends.
It's highly unlikely that end is coming anytime soon, but until David Simon creates his next series, fans will have to settle for rescreening episodes from their boxed sets. This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Radio.